This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Me and Jen and Brian bought a pretty little home. It was cheaper, and we split it, and we're fixing it up. So Mr. Sokol does everything, rewires, fixes cracks. I can only break walls, move stuff, and get snacks.
And I am downright amazed at what I can destroy with just a hammer. And I am downright amazed at what I can destroy with just a hammer.
Benvenido, benvenuto, welcome and twos and talk to my Norwegian cousins who may actually listen to this. Shout out Jan Harald and Uni, much love. I am Ben, better known as Boston Nuga, and this is the debut episode of Row 1, Seat 1, the podcast. You guys just heard the soothing strains of Adam and his package, making this the first wrestling theme focused podcast to use the song I'm downright amazed at what I can destroy with just a hammer as an intro. So we're already making history. But I'm sure you guys are asking, what the hell is this? Because I've been kind of secretive about it. Aside from being my friend, why the hell did you tune in to this secret project, and why did I create it? Other than the fact that apparently all white males have to have a podcast. Here's what I'm going to do with this podcast. I want to chronicle fandom through the prism of the live experience. That's why I called it Row 1, Seat 1. This is about being a fan, because I am nothing more than a fan, nothing more, nothing less. What I love the most is the stories of how people became fans through their first live wrestling shows or sporting events or that moment where they got hooked forever and never turned back. And that kind of started a lifetime love affair of going to more and more shows and live events and sporting events and having better and better experience. And so this is going to be a podcast that tells the story of being a fan. You'll notice that I didn't just say wrestling. This show is going to have a heavy wrestling focus, but I want to encompass live sports in general and even music. One guest I'm having coming on very soon is going to, having been to all 30 Major League Baseball parks. Another guest I'm planning on was going to have been to the Super Bowl very recently. I'm not going to discriminate so long as someone has had an amazing live experience. If I can get someone who spent 2 weeks following around the Ice Capades back in the 90s and did blow with Brian Boitano and has stories about it, you're damn well right I'm going to have him on the podcast. If you know someone who toured around with Metallica in the 80s, send him my DMs. I'd be happy to have him. Or went around with the circus, please. Totally cool. I would love to have on people who have had amazing live experiences with something. And it made them become a fan in real life. So that's what this podcast is going to be about. This is going to have a bit of a different bent than your average podcast, and I almost don't care about the present, especially when I have a wrestler or a promoter on. I'm not going to so much, you know, your average podcast is going to be like, tell me about your current career, tell me about who you're wrestling, tell me about the show you have coming up. I almost don't care about that. It's going to be a show about origin stories, how they fell in love with the sport, their parents taking them to their first show. We're not going to touch on current stuff. It's going to be about, except that, like, you know, if I have a wrestler on, I'm going to say, you know, how have your feelings as a fan changed now that you're in the business? A little bit about me. I grew up north of Boston, but I've been in Chattanooga about 9 years now. We never had much money growing up, so I didn't start going to shows until my 20s when I discovered Ring of Honor. I made up for it in my 30s, however. I've been to 6 Manias in about the last 10 years. My favorite live event ever was WrestleMania 30 in New Orleans when Daniel Bryan won the belt. I refer to that as the happiest I've ever been with my pants on because Bryan Danielson is my dude. I'm also a sports writer, so I've been to a lot of sporting events, luckily enough. And hopefully my journalism background will help provide a little bit of back and forth with this podcast a little bit. I also have a 5-year-old daughter named Ava, who I know a lot of you guys have probably seen on Twitter. She is the light of my life. She is the greatest thing to ever happen to me, and who I'm going to reference a bunch on this podcast because I'm just now starting to bring her to shows, and she has started to really get into shows, and she lights up when she sees her favorite wrestlers, and it just completely melts me. So, and actually Papa and I might talk about that as well, really the bringing kids to shows. So that's my spiel. Speaking of Papa, since this podcast at its core is about making towns, I had no choice for my first guest, rather than to have Mr. Making Towns as my first guest. The immortal Papa Hales. Welcome, Papa. Please watch out for the construction signs around town, but welcome to Row 1, Seat 1, Papa Hales.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here, and I always like to talk about my journey in wrestling, which is probably very unique when compared to most people. And hopefully we can kind of talk about that from the early years to where I am today.
Yeah, you've been on, you are 60-something years old. I don't know if you want to reveal your true age, but you're in your
60s. I'll be 67 in August.
Oh, geez. Well, we're going to cut you open and count the rings, but yeah. but you are definitely the number one independent fan in the country in the seniors division. I couldn't think of a better first guest to have on because you have seen it and done it, and you can provide a history that very few, if any, can provide. So talk a little bit about your origin story. What got you, more than 60 years ago into wrestling? And, a lot of us, it was just our parents just kind of introduced us to it. I know you and I have spent many, many hours in the car together and at shows together. And I remember you telling me that your parents, sort of got you into wrestling as well. You were in the upper Midwest, correct?
Yes, when my first exposure to wrestling actually came through my dad on my who got me watching wrestling and took me to my first few shows in Minnesota when I was just like literally a toddler, 3-4 years old, maybe 5, between 3 and 5. He took me to a couple of shows. And I honestly do not recall those shows. I just know from him telling me and my brother that he took us. But one memory that I have from living up in Minnesota, my dad got his teaching degree at what then was called Mankato State University. And
is that where Dauber was a coach?
Yes. His parents used to come over and feel the TV. Because we had one of those old black and white TVs, and my dad would put wrestling on. And his parents would say, you should be studying. You shouldn't be watching this crazy wrestling. So they would literally come over to the house and feel if the TV was warm. Have you been watching wrestling? So I have a few flashback memories of seeing wrestling literally in the mid-50s on TV.
That's awesome.
Up in Minnesota. And again, I went to a few shows up there, but I just have to be honest, I don't recall going. I only know I went because my dad told me.
That's so cool, though. Like, yeah, my first memory ever was WrestleMania 3. I just have, like, really vague memories of it. But, like, yeah, mine was kind of similar that, like, my dad would kind of drag me to watch wrestling, and I have vague memories of it. But it was just, like, you know, your parents just kind of get you into it, and it's one of those things where they kind of get you kicking and screaming until you're no longer kicking and screaming, right?
Right, right. And there were certain personalities up there in Minnesota that, as I got a little bit older and even after I moved, because I went back there every year because my grandparents and all my family are from there, I would see them. I know Vern Gagne was one of the main superstars up there at that time. And then a little bit later, even after we'd moved to Albuquerque, we'd go up in the summers and stuff, and I would see back then, I think it was AWA, mm-hmm. with Nick Bockwinkel and that cast of characters. Again, Gagne was involved in that, and Baron Von Raschke, some of those individuals were wrestling up there, and I would get to see a show occasionally, not often, but occasionally up in Minnesota in the 60s when I during the summer. But a lot of times, of course, I could watch them on TV too, because they had it was all over the Twin Cities, the TV there. So I saw a lot of those people from the upper Midwest. That used to be the NWA territory, mm-hmm. up there from like the mid-50s on. And then like in maybe 60, it became AWA, which was really a great promotion. It brought in a lot of huge stars. But by then I had moved to Albuquerque, I actually moved to Albuquerque in, I believe it was 59, might have been 58, but my first show there that I distinctly recall going to, my first wrestling show was in Albuquerque, which was probably in 59, and it was on the card with the Fabulous Kangaroos and Dory Funk Sr. I don't remember the rest of the card, but I remember I was just so excited about the Fabulous Kangaroos. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And my dad took me and my brother David, and we got in a fight, a scrap out in the parking lot, and I got knocked down and tore a hole in my new jeans. So, and of course, my dad was furious. And when we got home, my mom was furious because she had to fix those brand new jeans. They used to get these iron-on patches they would put on your blue jeans and stuff. So that's kind of my memory from that show, getting in a shoot fight with my brother. So that's about par for the course.
And that's when you fell in love, right?
That show really sticks out of that in my mind. And I have distinct memories of the Kangaroos and, of course, Dory. Senior and Dory Jr., I don't know whether he wrestled on that card or not. I remember Dory Senior, but that kind of started the ball rolling. And then after that show, we got where we would watch Mike London on TV every week. We would watch wrestling on TV. And I didn't find this out till years later, but I'd tell my dad, I said, well, let's go down and watch the wrestling. Let's go see the wrestling, you know, down on the TV. But I found out years later they didn't actually have wrestling in Albuquerque on TV. What they did in the studio there is they would record interviews, and they would record promos. And then Mike London, the promoter, would like get between and prevent a massive fight from breaking out. But all of the wrestling that they showed on TV was actually done in the Amarillo studios.
Oh.
Because Albuquerque was part of the Amarillo territory. And I didn't find this out till years later when I talked to Terry Funk in Dallas, WrestleMania week. I said, man, I said, we were trying to figure out how to find the wrestling there. And Terry said, no. He said they would tape in Amarillo, and they'd send the tape overnight, drive all night sending the tape, and then it'd appear on television in Albuquerque. So the only thing they ever recorded there, to my knowledge, I could be wrong, but I'm just going by my knowledge or my memory, is all of those TV interviews and promos for the next show. And we saw a number of shows in Albuquerque, of course, at the old Civic Auditorium there. Which was a big venue there in Albuquerque. And occasionally, not often, but occasionally my dad would take us to see shows in other areas. We went down, I believe, to Clovis, New Mexico. And I think we saw, well, I know we saw a card or two in Lubbock, and went to Amarillo a couple of times, including to the studios there in Amarillo.
That's a hike, isn't it?
It is. It's a ways from Albuquerque to Amarillo. is several hours' drive. The spaces out west are far apart.
Yeah.
There's nothing very close together. But we went down to El Paso once when I got some new glasses. We saw a show down there. But I wasn't going to wrestling shows every week, Ben. I would go maybe once a month. You know, maybe I'd go 6 weeks between shows. So it wasn't a constant thing of going to shows all the time like I do now.
A special treat.
It was, right. It was a treat. And my dad was a high school teacher at that time, and my mom taught school as well. So we were doing a lot of extra things, or going a lot of extra places. In the summer, our family would travel. We'd go to a lot of the national parks all around the country and whatnot. But during the year, my dad would take my brother Dave. I don't think my sisters ever went. I have two sisters, but I don't recall them ever going. It was always kind of a guy thing. It was my dad and my brother David and I. And occasionally they'd have like an activity in the area. Like Albuquerque, they would bring out some of the big stars. My first hero in professional wrestling was a guy named Rapid Ricky Romero. He was the first guy that really got me totally hooked on wrestling. Now, I remember my first show with the Kangaroos, which I thought was incredible, but he was the first character that I really brought into. And he was brought out from the coast, from California to the Amarillo Territory, and into Albuquerque, and made babyface by Dory Funk Sr. And back then, they did not have any Hispanic wrestlers wrestling.
I was going to say, he was huge in the Hispanic market. Was there a huge, I mean, it was Mexico. There had to have been a huge Hispanic market there, right?
They had, you know, basically told him, don't bring him out there because he won't be accepted out there in West Texas and New Mexico because we haven't ever had a Hispanic star. But he proved him wrong. He was like the biggest baby face that I can recall, you know, 12 years that I was living out in Albuquerque, and won numerous titles and had numerous feuds with good guys, bad guys. They had a big feud with the Funks for a while, with the Funks playing the heels. And Ricky was pretty much always a baby face, but he also teamed with Terry. Many times I had a nice long conversation with Terry in Dallas when Dallas was last WrestleMania was there, and we talked about Ricky Romero, and I mentioned a couple of things, and he actually remembered the matches, and he got a little misty eyed, and he said, you know, Ricky's one of the greatest guys ever in this industry. And we got a little quiet there for a while and kind of clammed up. We started talking Ricky Romero stories because he was such a great character in the ring, and he was also such a good person. And that's one thing Terry recalled.
Now, you got a unique perspective because you had, a good 12, 15 years of being able to watch the evolution of the Funks? Talk a little bit about their evolution, because you saw, you know, Terry and Dory Jr. basically from their genesis.
Well, now, of course, Dory Sr. was already a big star when I got involved, you know, got into the whole thing. In fact, he was promoting a lot of that territory from Texas to New Mexico, even up in Colorado, and he had contacts all over, and a great record as a trainer. But Dory Jr. is a good bit older than Terry. I don't know how many years are between the two of them, but Dory Jr. is a good bit older than Terry. And he burst on the scene first at the top high level. He just had that raw-boned West Texas image that has always been portrayed by the Funks. And such a hard worker in the ring. And paid very close attention to details. I felt like even from the time when he was very young, trying to make sure that he had the timing right, that he was portraying the character the right way. And so I think the Funks understood what wrestling was. They understood the performance art aspect of wrestling, and they carried it to a level that you rarely see even today. So Dory came across first to me, and of course I love the spinning toe hold. That was such an incredible hold, and no one to my knowledge did anything quite like that. And that as a finisher was quite amazing to see and watch, and of course everybody always wanted to see that put on. Terry Funk was very young when I first met him. Now, Terry's older than me, but not by a lot. He may be 5 years older than me. Terry, I think because of the influence of his father and the influence of his brother, became one of the greatest, if not the greatest, professional wrestler in history.
You won't get an argument from me there. Yeah.
He ranks as number one in my book. In terms
Terry's
of
74,
overall,
so yeah.
Right. In terms of his overall contribution to wrestling, because of his longevity, because of what he was able to create in the ring, because of his influence on other people, promotions around the world. He's literally a god in Japan. And when he went over to Japan, he was supposed to be a heel, like all Americans. But his work, his craft was so incredible, the audience just absolutely consumed him to the point that he became the biggest babyface in Japan. Because of his hard work, because of the struggle that he portrayed in the ring.
He was an everyman. Just,
you're right, just absolutely incredible. And then his work all through the years, his feuds in Memphis with Flair, his feuds with so many of the big characters in wrestling, his work in ECW, and his influence is absolutely incredible.
But you saw him live probably a million times. How did his work develop? Because you saw him as a baby, you know, and then you saw him obviously, you know. Did he grow up quick? Did he take a little while to, you know, to percolate? I mean, you saw him come up.
He did not immediately impress me as a superstar, because the superstar of the Funk family was Dory Jr. Mm-hmm. when I was getting heavily involved in wrestling. Of course, he became the NWA champ. It was years later that Terry ascended up to the higher levels. So Terry had to work his way up. When I first saw Terry, he was on his way or already at West Texas State to play football. And I think that Dory went there too. A lot of wrestlers out there went to West Texas State at that, you know, to play football.
Tito Tully, yeah.
Yeah, and at that time, and it's still that way today. Most wrestlers don't just wrestle; they have other jobs too. So it wasn't uncommon for a star to have other jobs, and. Strangely enough, that's been that way in every major sport. I remember big league baseball players back in the 60s, they had to work in the offseason.
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking Hall of Famers. I'm talking guys like Harmon Killebrew.
Especially before the reserve clause.
You know, mm-hmm. they had to work. They had to have jobs in the offseason if they're going to feed their families. And wrestling has always been that way, too. But Terry's evolution, I think, when he first came out, he was, to me, he was just a guy. The times that I saw him, I said, well, I mean, people liked him because he had the Funk name and everything. But I think he just became a sponge. He took in everything. And Dory Jr. was such a great role model as his big brother, because Dory invented a number of major moves in wrestling. And very innovative. And having a dad like Dory Sr., he was able to grow up around the greatest wrestlers in the world. I mean, when you're you know, dealing with guys like Harley Race and the Briscoes and the Von Erichs and all these guys that you have the opportunity to meet and to have matches with and get involved with, you can't help but get better. But I think Terry took the advantage, maximum advantage, of learning everything that he could. And each place that he went, he did something different.
Very true.
He did something different in ECW, did something different in WCW and WWE and
Memphis.
Very different in Memphis, very different in Japan. So I think learning and developing his skills, one of the most amazing things to me about Terry that I've thought of over the years, he's just such an incredible guy on camera. He's so great as a promo and as selling a story. And that's kind of a lost art for a lot of these wrestlers now. There's, you know, there was a time, I think, when wrestlers, as a general rule, were a little bit better, and he was a master of that.
So you went from Albuquerque to Chattanooga, correct?
That's correct.
You went for school, right?
Yes, I did. My dad got a job teaching at UTC, mm-hmm. which then University of Chattanooga, then later became UTC, UT Chattanooga.
Now, you told me stories of a friend that you made there.
Yes. I actually, when I was a freshman at UTC, which would have been in 1970, I got the job as a sports editor for the paper. So I would cover all the various sports and whatnot, and I met a lot of people and had a lot of friends, and my dad had contacts. And one of the guys that I met at school was a guy named Pez Yvonne Whatley, who was a very good wrestler, excellent wrestler. And UT Chattanooga had a coach named Jim Morgan, very good coach, and had a lot of great teams in him before your time, but very strong wrestling team. And Pez was one of the best wrestlers on the team. He was a heavyweight. In fact, I think he went to Notre Dame.
He went to Notre Dame High School, yep. And he was the first, all state. He was the first African American to win states in the state of Tennessee.
He was the first, also the first black wrestler at UTC. Mm-hmm. So because I was hanging out at the athletic department a good bit of the time, I got to know a lot of these athletes. And a friend of mine named Steve Highlander, who is now the head of the school board, in Chattanooga, was, I believe him and Pez were roomies or right next to each other. And I knew Steve well, too. And my dad knew Pez because he had him in class. So I got to where Pez and Highlander and other people would hang out and talk, especially over at the Student Union and various other places, because UTC wasn't the big campus then that it is now. It was much smaller then. But I got to know Pez quite well. In fact, I've been over to his house. I've eaten over at his house a couple of times. And we've been out hanging out many, many times. His actual goal when he left school was he wanted to be a power lifter.
He was a big dude. He was a big dude. And he ended up doing MMA, too.
And so he did go out and do powerlifting for a while. He didn't go straight into professional wrestling. But so I knew him. He was the first wrestler that I got to know outside of what's happening in the ring. That was really because of school activities and stuff.
You had the bug, obviously, for live wrestling, and you were in Chattanooga. How did you discover live wrestling in Chattanooga? What was the live wrestling like, and how did it differ from New Mexico?
Very different type of wrestling. Well, Tennessee wrestling is very character driven, or at least it was at that time. We're dealing with the territories initially, because when I came into Chattanooga in the late 60s, Chattanooga was really run by Nick Gulas promotions. And Harry Thornton was one of the local promoters, Roy Welch, Nick Gulas, and Thornton. Harry Thornton was a fixture on TV in Chattanooga. And Harry was a crazy guy. He also had a morning show with a gal named Ruth Bloyer. They were on every morning. And Harry would spout all kinds of craziness. And he was quite a personality here locally. And I knew Harry fairly well. He knew me by name. And he would have wrestling in the studio every week. Now, I went down there a number of times. And I was talking to Mama today. Mama Hales and I went out to lunch. I said, did you ever go with us? I didn't think she had. She said, no. My brother David and I went to see studio wrestling a number of times. Now, we weren't there all the time. But we went down there a number of times. I couldn't tell you exactly how many. But I always enjoyed it. But we rarely missed watching it on TV. That was like a fixture for us, is to watch Harry Thornton wrestling on TV. And sometimes we would torture Mom and make her watch, too. So that was a regular staple item. And we went to a number of big shows in Chattanooga at Memorial Auditorium. Now, it's got a different name now. I forget what they call it.
I think it's still called Memorial Auditorium.
Yeah. People would pack in that place, the upstairs balcony area, plus the downstairs, and the biggest stars in wrestling came through there. Flair, Andre the Giant, I remember meeting him, and that was like a huge thing. We laughed because his voice was so low, and he had huge hands. And, of course, back then, everything was kayfabe. So he didn't know who we were, if that makes sense. It was a lot different than it is now, where you actually might know a wrestler personally. Back then, that was unheard of. Now, there were a few that I did know personally, but not many. I knew Pez personally, of course, but that was because of the school connection and just hanging out and stuff. Didn't really have anything to do with the wrestling, although we talked about the wrestling and stuff as he got into it and was doing stuff, and I would occasionally see him. But back then, that's one of the biggest changes I've seen as a fan in wrestling, is kayfabe was really kept. You didn't know what was going on in people's lives. You didn't know people outside of what they presented to you in the ring.
Right.
Even big stars that I got to see frequently, and I knew, and they would recognize me, but they probably had no idea what my name was. For instance, guys like Jackie Fargo. Because I saw Jackie a number of times. He was on TV all the time, and I would see him wrestle at the studio on occasion and down at Memorial Auditorium, and he would basically kind of nod, like, yeah, I've seen you, I know you. But there was no actual interaction, if that makes sense.
It's an arm's distance, yeah.
Right.
That's interesting. And now there's Twitter, so we know everything.
There was no Twitter then.
No Twitter then. You know?
But the difference, I think, largely in moving from the Southwest, from that Amarillo territory to the Chattanooga area, was the real emphasis on characters. Real heavy characters in the South and the Chattanooga area, and a lot of managers, a lot of teams, a lot of emphasis on developing the characters, maybe more so than any other place I've ever been. And it's not that the wrestling wasn't good, but it's almost like the connection with the fans and the character development was paramount.
Well, that's interesting. Was the studio? And you went to the studio a couple times, you said, right?
Yeah. Yes.
My frame of reference for that is Memphis. I haven't seen Chattanooga studio wrestling. Was it a lot like Memphis studio wrestling, or was it completely different?
Much like Memphis studio wrestling in a lot of ways. Regular, and you see the regular characters on there, small little bleachers set up. Mm-hmm. This was at Channel 12 most of the time, but I believe he also did it at Channel 3. Not sure I ever went at Channel 3. But you kind of see the same characters. There was a lady that would usually sit in the front and always chase them around with a pocketbook. I remember one time I chased Tojo Yamamoto with a slide rule, you know. So I did know Tojo, and he knew my name. But we weren't friends, you know, best friends or anything. But he's one of the guys that actually knew my name. But most of them might have recognized me from seeing me at enough places. But remember, I'm not going all the time. I'm going, you know, maybe every you know, 6-8 weeks to the studio, and then shows, you know, not that often.
So at what point do you have the boys?
All right. We moved from Chattanooga to Charleston in 1981?
Mm-hmm.
83. 82. It was January of 82. Dylan was born in August of 81. We moved in January of 82 to Charleston.
Okay.
Now, when I moved to Charleston, from the time I lived in Charleston to the time I came back to Tennessee, which is about 2000, that was a period of about 20 years that I went into a black hole, because we raised four boys during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working full time. There were periods before I got my teaching certificate that I was working multiple jobs. So I might be working 2-3 different jobs and throwing newspapers in the morning.
Jeez.
Just to keep food on the table. So I was not going to a ton of shows at that time. Now, I was still watching on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I was still watching the product all the time. And it's never been far away from my mind, because it's always been a part of my life. But back in Charleston, for those 20 years, the boys, especially Dylan, Dylan saw tons more wrestling than I did. My brother loved wrestling. He lived with us off and on when we lived in Charleston. So we went to a few shows there, and I went to a fair number of shows, but it wasn't a regular attender there. Dylan, on the other hand, went to almost every single WCW show because he had a contact that worked security, or his dad worked security. So boys would go down there early. Gotcha. And they go down there early, and they'd hang out with the talent and throw football with them and get really good seats and got to meet a lot of the, you know. So the boys were really heavy into it. I do think that Dylan developed a love for wrestling partly because of the fact that I was in it. So Uncle David was into it heavy. So that maybe kind of got it in his mind to start with. That's where it kind of came from. But Dylan became really interested in it very early, and as a very young guy, he began ordering newsletters, getting magazines, and of course I liked those old wrestling magazines too.
Oh yeah.
And then he became one of the earlier tape traders, and he just began watching thousands and thousands and thousands of matches from all over the world. So all of this was happening around me. My son Drew was also a fan at that point, but eventually he turned sour when Hulk Hogan turned heel. That turned Drew off. That's it. I'm not watching it. But Dylan really was going to many more shows than I was.
Yeah. Okay. Did he get a chance to bring the boys to the occasional show though? Because that's what I'm getting to experience now with Ava, is that like I'm getting to bring her to her first couple shows and getting to watch her light up. And for me, and I'm sure you see it as a parent, and I can even see you through Ava's eyes, because basically you're her de facto grandfather in a lot of ways. Like it's entirely different seeing a show through my child's eyes than it is seeing a show through my own eyes when I'm at a show by myself. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, seeing Dylan and his reactions, and you know, we saw some very, I remember I took him to a show with his Uncle Dale. We went to a show at King Street Palace. That's one of the first experiences I remember Dylan going with us. And he loved the environment. That's such a legendary building there in Charleston. And the show was not very good, but just the experience was great. And we went to a number of other local shows and matches. And I remember one, Charles Robinson, the WWE ref, was there. And we had a cheering section going for Charles at that show. And I think the main event there was the loser wears a diaper, as I recall. And I think it was at James Island High School. So, yes, we did have a number of shows that we were able to go to. And, of course, a really big event would come to Charleston. We'd try and go. Dylan went to the events. When he graduated from high school, I took Dylan up on an ECW tour. And we went up to see ECW shows in Allentown, Pennsylvania, Asbury Park. And that was a blast. We also went to see a really good ECW show in Columbia, South Carolina once.
How many parents take their kids on an ECW tour? Can we just soak that in for a second? Like, seriously.
That's true. And
my parents took look at ECW and said, there's no fucking way you're going to any of this.
Yep. And I'll never forget the fairgrounds in Allentown. It was a fans bring weapons match.
Jesus
and a near riot broke out at that particular show. So that's very memorable. And then the Asbury Park with the old venue and just some of the great stars of ECW, that was awesome too.
It's amazing.
So there were those opportunities to do some things together as a family. And this was mostly with Dylan at that time. And again, there was for that probably close to 20-year period, Dylan went to many more shows than I did and was watching much more wrestling than I was. Because back at then, my exposure to watching wrestling was like the Monday Night Wars. I wasn't watching indie wrestling. I was watching the big boys, you know, WWE, WCW. Of course, I was taking all of that in, but I wasn't being exposed to the kinds of things that Dylan was exposed to. I actually learned about that later.
So you came back to Chattanooga, you said, in 2000?
Yes.
Okay. And then Dustin and Devin, I know they started going to some independent shows when they came back.
That's correct.
Did you start going to shows with them as well? Because I know they started really getting into the local independent scene. And I know Chattanooga really had a thriving independent scene in the mid-2000s, you know, early 2010s and things like that.
Yes, the boys would go almost every week to UEW, which featured wrestlers like Tank and Iceberg out there in East Ridge, and their uncle Dale usually took them. I only went there a couple of times. They went there as regulars. So they were just really developing their own fandom, kind of led by their brother Dylan into it, and they knew I loved it. They knew my brother David loved it. But they developed their own fandom, cut it on indie wrestling here in the Chattanooga area, because there was quite a number of good indie shows and places to go where you could catch some really fine indie wrestling in the Chattanooga area. In fact, Chattanooga's always been a hub, as long as I can remember, of good wrestling. When I first came here, it was controlled by the Amarillo Territory. And you had all those Amarillo stars coming down, the Jarretts, occasionally you'd get Lawler in here, and of course Flair was in town, Tojo Yamamoto, and you get all of those guys come in. But then eventually we kind of became an intersection for other areas, because we get people up from Georgia Championship Wrestling, Gordon Soley, not. All those folks would come into the Chattanooga area. Then you'd get some Smoky Mountain influence. So,
the city is it's the intersection of, like, I'm 2 hours from Atlanta, I'm 2 hours from Nashville, I'm 3 hours from Asheville, I'm 6 hours from St. Louis, I'm, you know, 7-8 hours from Chicago. We're equidistant to so many things that I can get anywhere I could possibly hope to want to get to. We're 4 hours from Florida. I mean, you know, we're 6 hours from Florida. Like, we can, there's so much that's accessible from the city that, yeah, it's a hub.
And people don't realize how many great wrestlers have been here and wrestled in Chattanooga. Like I said, I don't think you get much bigger in terms of name recognition than Andre the Giant. And of course, Ric Flair and Lawler and all of those guys. And the guys, stars, Minnesota Wrecking Crew coming up from Atlanta area, a lot of those Atlanta stars coming through, and Iron Sheik, and just tons and tons of just incredible stars, Ricky Steamboat, guys that are legends, Flair. It was a hotbed of activity. And we've had a few wrestlers from this area that have done quite well. Pez was really did quite well. I really think he could have and probably should have done better. I don't think they had the same booking opportunities for great black athletes back then that they do now. Terry Bam Bam Gordy's from the area. So we've had some good wrestlers from this specific area. But I think the Chattanooga location is a crossroads. Is the reason that we have such a storied history of wrestling in this region.
So let me read this first. This is the Place to Be In live read, and then once we do that, then I'll get into the Papa Hales Renaissance. On the Place to Be In pop feed, we had a busy week on the pop feed with a little something for everyone. Russell and Sam dish about the classic Empire Records and a new 90s to nothing. In this month's Talk and Pop, Jenny and Tim welcome JT Rosero to relive the magic of WrestleMania weekend in New York City. Ben Morse and Russell Sellers talk the first half of 1970 in a new Marvel Age masterclass. Adam and Andrew deliver in-depth playoff previews on a dual offering on the NBA Team podcast. Todd Weber and Tim Capel look at Uncanny X-Men number 136, plus more. In the latest episode of Conversation Comics, the hard-traveling fanboys review Shazam and this week's offering. Cowboy and D'Amato are back in the saddle with a new This Week in Sports, and they catch up on everything since the Super Bowl. Todd welcomes JT to Binge Please as they take on the Netflix Marvel Universe and Daredevil Season 1. Todd also joined Andy to talk Swingers in the third episodes of Laugh-In Theater. Coming at the end of May, the Hard Traveling Fanboys will be wrapping up their Hard Travelers for Hire series with a special giant size edition of the podcast. Greg and Nick will be joined by past guests for a retrospective look back at the highs and lows of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they want your opinions. After you've seen Endgame, send in your full ranking of the MCU movies from 1 to 22 to Nick D at placetobenation.com. The full composite rankings for Place to Be Nation will be revealed on the show, so get your ballots in to make your voice heard. On the Place to Be in Wrestling feed, in the premiere episode of Making Towns of Friends, Steve and Rich explore what could have been had if a Money in the Bank match had occurred at every WrestleMania since inception. JT and Scott were joined by Todd Weber for episode 517 of the Place to Be podcast, and they broke down the March 1989 MSG House Show. JT and Chad returned with a new Wrestling War Zone, and they finished off 1995 with a discussion about Starrcade. So check out our social media pages and a message board at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in the conversation today and start researching your list. And be sure to check out placetobenation.com as things are getting back up and running there. With plenty of projects and reviews to come, content will be picking up in the days and weeks ahead. All right, Papa. Now we're going to talk about the Papa Hales Renaissance, because that is where I've gotten to know you. I've been here since 2010, and I've known the fun and crazy and retired Papa Hales, and the Papa Hales who has been Mr. Indie Show, Mr. Show in general, really, Mr. Live Experience, Mr. Making Towns, you always loved wrestling, but I don't know if anyone over the last decade has loved wrestling as much as Papa Hales. What made you when people ask me, because I peeling back the curtain a little bit, I've been, I guess the word is handler, is that fair?
Yes. Oh yeah, I always gotta have a handler.
I've been one of your primary handlers over the last couple years or so, and people ask me, you know, what's it like to handle Papa Hales, and I try to say that he only knows sixth gear, and you've pretty much been in sixth gear since I've known you. So what made you shift into sixth gear as far as being Mr. Wrestling Fan and Mr. Making Towns in your retirement? What turned the switch?
Well, when I had to retire, which was not by choice, it was health reasons, I had a very critical health issue, heart issue, diabetes, and vision issues. And I literally left the classroom and went to the hospital and talked to my heart surgeons, and we scheduled open heart surgery. And I was told I was not going to be able to go back to teaching. So, it just kind of happened all of a sudden. And I was only 62 years old. So we're going on 5 years now. And it was pretty devastating for me because I love teaching. It's been my life's work, coaching and teaching young people. I don't really miss the bull crap. I don't miss the adults, but I do miss the kids.
Sure.
And because it was such a huge part of my life, and so much of my life was devoted to kids, being with kids, teaching kids, and learning from kids, it made a huge hole in my life when I left teaching and wasn't able to go back. And I had my heart surgery, I believe it was in September, is that right, Meredith? I had my heart surgery in September. And there was a period of recovery after that, 2 or 3 months, when I really wasn't able to do much of anything because it was a pretty significant surgery event. And unfortunately, because I've always been, like you said, a sixth gear guy, nonstop, always going, constant moving, constant thinking.
Still
are. I'm 100% a people person.
Yes.
Some people do great in quiet locations and solitude. That's just not me, as you know.
That's why we get along so well.
Right. Yeah. So I went into a pretty bad depression after all of this because I knew, you know what, I'm not going to be able to go back and do what I love doing. I've had to retire early. I'm too young for this. I've got to fill my time with something that interests me, that I love. I can't go back to teaching kids right now. And wrestling has always held a special place for me. You know, I had rough times when I was a kid growing up. That would kind of take that pressure off. That would take it. It filled an important spot in my life. And it's a place where you can escape to. It's a place where you can see human drama played out.
Yeah.
I think for some people, it's reading. For some people, it's music. For me, it just happened to be wrestling. That was a place I could go and kind of put my troubles aside and focus on that. And it's always been that way for me from the time I was a little kid. You know, even struggling with issues as a little kid. And then all through some hard times and tough times in Charleston. And then I lost my brother, David. And that was a very tough time. And last year I lost a son. So wrestling has filled a space for me. It's been a place of refuge and a place where human drama plays out, but it plays out in a storybook way. It allows me to escape the hard things, the harsh things of life, and enjoy something that really makes me happy.
It's catharsis.
Because I can see all of the emotion. I can see all of the physical struggle, the mental struggle played out in the ring, which has really been beneficial to me. And I think it's beneficial to a lot of people. I began in January after my surgery, started to go to shows. I never intended to become a total crazy nut traveling all over, going to every show in the world.
I don't believe you.
But I had the time, and I didn't have a lot of money, but I had enough money where I could travel a little, and I had a bunch of free miles on my a couple of credit cards, so I could travel for free on air. And we didn't spend a lot of money on fancy food or fancy hotels and stuff like that. It was basically wrestling tickets and as inexpensive travel as we could get. And I had the time, and that was the most critical thing, is I needed time. But as I began to travel around, I began to realize, my God, I love this so much. This takes me to my happy place. And I meet so many interesting and good people out on the road. It just became kind of a compulsion for me. So it wasn't really planned, but as I began to travel, and again, I had the time, which was the most important thing, I ended up going to all the way from Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., North Carolina, Florida, Missouri, Chicago many times, out to the West Coast, Las Vegas and Texas and St. Louis and tons of points in between. And it just became something that was so exciting and so real to me. And I guess the thing that has been most important to me is meeting people on the way. And it's not just wrestlers. It's not just referees or promoters. Mostly it's just normal people or everyday people. And I guess in my mind, everybody's normal. I don't think wrestling should be reserved for any one group. Wrestling should be open to everyone and welcoming to everyone. Come as you are, be accepted for who you are. People need to be loved and cared for and be brought into a special community where they can enjoy the benefits of wrestling.
Totally agree.
And so it's been a journey that's been a lot of fun. And I get a little crazy sometimes. I'll admit that.
Yes, you do. I love it, though. I wouldn't have you any other way.
But some of the major shows, of course, I've been to a lot of WrestleManias in the last 5 years. Been to a lot of Evolve shows, a lot of the major promotions around the country, Ring of Honor shows, a lot of those. I've been to AAW and Freelance in Chicago. I've been to a number of promotions up in New York area. And CZW, I've been out to a number in the St. Louis area, Glory Pro and Anarchy and others.
I won't make you pick your favorite, don't worry.
Oh, no, but I've just been to a lot. And wrestling has experienced a rejuvenation in the Chattanooga area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to almost every Empire show. Dylan and I would go and the boys would go. I got really, really into the Empire wrestling on the indie level during this period. And, of course, they're no longer running, but that was where the first Scenic City Invitational was held. And I'm one of the few people, there are a few of us, that have been to every SCI.
As have I. That's where I met you, actually.
And I'm actually working on some, I've got a good deal. I'm gonna produce some enamel pins for SCI.
Cool.
And this could be a special announcement for your show because I haven't announced anybody yet. I got a guy that's going to make them for me, relatively inexpensive, where I can at least get my money back. I don't care about making any, but they're gonna produce them, Scenic City Invitational enamel pins, and for people that have been here for every year, this will be the fifth year. I'm going to have a five in there, Roman numeral five. If you've been there 4 years, you'll get a 4, 3, 2, and 1. And the people coming for the first time will get the pin with a 1 on it. So I think that's kind of cool.
And then you and I are going to have some discussions this week about other Scenic City announcements as well.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have a full list of activities like we have the last few years, because I think that's one of the things about Scenic City that sets it apart. I've traveled all over the country, as you know, and you've been to most places too, or many. There's no place in the world that I've been to that has the same unique experience for fans that Scenic City does. There's done nothing like it.
My favorite weekend of the year, because it's just like one big family reunion. It's the most welcoming place on earth. And you have a large part to do with that, because it's just this big welcoming. Everyone come as they are. I mean, like you talk about with wrestling, it's just, you know, this little, it's this little encompassing thing like that, where everyone just gathers at the hotel and everyone's cool with each other and everyone's happy, and you know, we all are just bonded by this one big crazy thing that's wrestling, and it's this wonderful place, and it makes me so happy. And you know, I'm just so thankful that we get to have that.
Well, I'm expected to see Ava around there this year.
We're gonna try to get Ava to Futures. That's going to be the goal.
Yeah, tremendous. Because she's like my little surrogate granddaughter.
I'm touched. Yeah, that's the other thing. We're going to talk about Mickey Towns at the end here. We'll wrap up in a second here. But the other thing I want to just touch on, too, is you become a promoter over the last, year and a half or so. How has your fandom changed? And your eye for talent changed, and how you look at wrestling changed since you become a promoter? Because more than any promoter I know, it's very hard for you at your shows to not be a fan, because you literally sit in the front row during your shows, and it's the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life, because you really like all your entire being wants to be a fan, but you have to promote your shows. How does that change you?
Surprisingly, it hasn't changed me a lot in terms of my fandom, because although I do have a very specific show that I promote, or a very specific promotion that I work with, it has defined characteristics, and it doesn't consume all of my time. And Jeremy Snyder is the co-owner of Making Towns with me, but our primary talent and Booker is Dylan Hales. So Dylan is doing a lot of the work with talent. Jeremy is doing a lot of the nuts and bolts work as far as getting together, the stuff for the videos, as far as helping balance the budget and doing all of those. Basically, all I'm doing is running around telling people, come to this great show. So somehow I managed to be the promoter, but still maintain my status as a fan. I don't run in the back, and I don't work in the back. I have someone else. Dylan helps me. Matt Griffin, I don't mind. Think he would mind me saying. He's been a huge help to me. Scott Hensley, you've been a huge help to me. So I have people that I have to rely on and depend on. The folks at TWE Arena, TWE Promotion in Chattanooga have been a huge help to me. Bailey Newman and several of the others. So what I've done is I've learned to delegate a lot of that responsibility to other people who know what they're doing. And then I can focus on the stuff that I think I'm good at, which is reaching out to people, getting excited for what's going to be a fantastic event, really get, you know, having a positive social media presence and reaching out, trying to get people to support what's going to be a fantastic event, and to bring women's wrestling to the Chattanooga area, to this area, this region, on a regular basis with a really good product. So I think I don't want to grow too fast. I don't want to get too big. I don't want to be too small. I think we've kind of found our area. We found our niche, and we're very happy with what we produce. This will be our fourth show. I've been very happy with each of the shows, and we've got really good feedback. We've got things we need to correct. We always do. But I just think the future looks good for us. We're financially in a good place, which is important, because if you can't at least break even, you shouldn't be promoting wrestling shows.
This is true. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and more importantly, Ava is looking forward to it. She is counting down the days to she gets to see Alley Cat. She is through the roof already about it, and I've already been like, she says, when do we go get to see Alley Cat? When do we go get to see Alley Cat? So, and she can't wait to see you, because you, like, just from a personal perspective, the way you've adopted her, and just like you say, you're her surrogate grandfather, but it's the truth. Like, you have become so great with her at wrestling shows, and I can't thank you enough. Like, you've just been absolutely wonderful helping, you know, to introduce her to wrestling, and just thank you from the bottom of my heart. I really appreciate it, because she's just she's, you know, like you did with your boys, she's embracing something that I love and that we love, and it's really cool to see something through a 5-year-old's eyes.
Oh, thanks for saying that. But she's such a great little gal. I mean, you know, I love her to death.
You do.
In fact, when we were in up in New Jersey for Mania, one of the happiest times for me is when you just happened to call home and talk to her. And I just heard her little voice, and I thought, oh, my God, this is so great. And when I see her, she just lights up the world. And she's got her little dresses.
She does.
And by golly, she's going to be a princess.
She is a princess.
I've gotten to know her as a human being, and I just think that's important. And understanding, and I wish more people were enough of a good parents to give their kids time to let them grow, to understand them. And Ava's sometimes she's a little bit harder to deal with than others.
She's a handful sometimes, yes.
We all are.
Oh, yeah.
Last time I saw her at TWE, she was just like so excited and just nonstop talking. But sometimes she's a little shy.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel good about the fact that I've been able to help her break out a little bit, because she'll see a wrestler, and I know she likes that wrestler, but she doesn't want to go up to them. So sometimes I'll just go up to the wrestler and say, if you get a chance, please try and come by and say hi or whatever. And I think that's helped break the ice with her, and I think it makes her happy.
Oh, it does. It does. And the fact that there's an environment like Making Towns, you know, that is so family friendly and is friendly to, you know, my daughter and I, is going to be absolutely wonderful. And if there's anyone who's in the Chattanooga area or in Tennessee or in Georgia or something like that, and is looking for a good night out with, you know, with the kids or just, you know, something that's downright wholesome. I can't recommend Making Towns highly enough because, I mean, you know, I trusted enough to bring my 5-year-old there, you know, so that says everything that needs to be said. So, Papa, you want to plug it and we'll wrap up for a little bit here. Tell us a little bit about Making Towns, when and where, and give me the details.
Yes, we are so excited. It's our second annual Making Towns Classic right here in Chattanooga at the TWE Arena on Dayton Boulevard in Red Bank. And it definitely is a family show. Tickets are $15. If you've got some kids in tow, I'll be working the door. Talk to me. We might be able to drop a little on the little one. But adults are $15, and I'll be working the door. We expect to have a good crowd, and the show is going to be fantastic. We're bringing in some of the best women's wrestlers on the planet.
Who's going to be there? Give us some names.
That's not hype. That's real. Kristen Stadlander, and Shaza McKenzie, Savannah Evans, Alley Cat, people at the very top of the indie ranks of women's wrestling. Alley Cat pretty much stole the show WrestleMania week on the indie scene for women. So the lineup is fantastic. Aja Pereira is coming in. She'll be battling in a really cool match that's not part of the tournament. Aja's a wonderful wrestler. We've had our differences. Yeah. So I'm hoping you will improve her attitude because her wrestling is phenomenal. But this is a great venue with nice, comfy chairs and
padded chairs. You can fall asleep in these chairs.
And they have a good, really great atmosphere there, a great place to watch the wrestling show. We expect to have a really good house, and boy, we sure would like to pack the house for that show because it's going to be great. I've mentioned some of the wrestlers. Another wrestler coming in from Milwaukee that I think is one to watch, a girl named Sierra. She's a big star, or going to be a big star. I talked to my friends at Shimmer and Rise, and they say, boy, she moving up
heard
the ranks.
Really good things about her, yeah.
So it's going to be an incredible show. It's May the 3rd, which is not this Friday, but the Friday after. I think we'll open doors maybe 6:45.
Bell time 7:30, and it's 4825 Dayton Boulevard in Red Bank, Tennessee, which is basically Chattanooga.
That's correct. And they can follow us at Making Towns Wrestling. And they can get tickets at MakingTownsWrestling.com on the internet, and you can order your tickets right over the internet, or you can get them at the door.
The Twitter handle is just at MakingTowns.
Yes.
Papa, it's been a pleasure and an honor. I love you. I respect you. I thank you so much for coming on this first podcast. You are seriously like a surrogate father and a friend and a grandfather to my child, and I just can't thank you enough, sir. So thank you for coming on the maiden voyage here.
All right. Happy to talk to you, as always, and I'll see you this week. We'll be talking SCI.
We will be talking SCI. We're going to have some announcements coming up soon.
First weekend of August. Everybody better be here at SCI because we're going to have a party.
Fantastic.
At the best weather. All right.
Love you, Papa. I'll talk to you soon.
Love you.
Because of your hair, wherever you go, you break everything everywhere. This year, things here now get on your way. Shut up the Sarah Corrin and the digital relay. Some people, they think he's Rastafarian because he has these big dreadlocks. And they ask him for pot. I think I like it. I know I like it.